Today, from Melbourne's property frontline. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today I'm joined by Catherine Cashmore. Hello there, Catherine.
Hi, Martin. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much for spending some time with us. And I have to say, it's great to have somebody from Melbourne talk to me, not because of what's happening with the virus, but because the property dynamic in Melbourne is quite different from perhaps other places, particularly now. But I'd like to start just by giving you a chance to introduce yourself, because I find it quite complex to explain what you do, because you do financial education, you're a buyer's agent, publishing, a lot of other things. So tell the story a bit, will you?
Yeah, so I effectively have three roles that I do. One is that I'm president of Australia's oldest economics organisation, Prosper Australia, which is advocating for taxation reform, really taking taxes off income and productivity and putting them onto monopoly rents, such as land rents and, you know, banking profits and so on and so forth. So we do a lot of work there regarding if any of your viewers might have heard of the speculative vacancies report that we do, where we analyse how many properties are vacant in the greater metropolitan Melbourne area based on water data usage, for example, over a calendar year. And that one gets a lot of publicity, which is why I mention it. But we do an awful lot of advocacy with government about how to change our economy. I laugh because of, you know, what a big task that is. So that's one thing I do. The other thing is that I write for Portfolio Publishing, a publication called Cycles, Trends and Forecasts, as well as Cashmore's Real Estate Wealth. Cycles, Trends and Forecasts is really focused on economic cycles, primarily the real estate cycle. So we do a lot on the 18-year real estate cycle, which is something that is very evident in the US and the UK, for example, in particular, but we have synchronized with that cycle at times, and we certainly do at the moment. And then I also run a buyer advocacy real estate agency where I assist, you know, buyers to buy real estate and educate them on, you know, how to take advantage of a system which isn't changing. And if you want to invest in real estate, you really need to understand how the system works, because whilst we advocate and we don't like what it's doing in Australia, you know, if you want to make money and you don't want to retire a renter, or that you want to retire with some wealth and you're going to do that through real estate, then I want to make sure that you do it the right way. So we do, I teach real estate investment through that and help buyers and also assist developers who want to find sites for development.
Right. Well, sounds like you run a pretty busy existence down there, despite everything. But look, there are so many areas that I'd like to explore. We probably won't be able to explore all of them in our first chat, but hopefully you can come back and, you know, spend some more time. But I would like to just explore a couple of specific things. And the one I want to touch on is the last point that you made, and that is that there are many things that people don't know but need to know about the real estate sector, and particularly when they're trying to transact within it. And, you know, I keep seeing this again and again, because basically a lot of people just seem to grab the information off the publicly available portals and assume that information is all 100% correct and giving an accurate view. And then they basically do some brief due diligence and then, you know, commit. There are so many pitfalls, though, aren't there? So where do you start the conversation with somebody who's saying, I'm interested in real estate?
Yeah, I mean, I usually start the conversation by talking about the cycle and teaching how land is treated within the economy that we live in, because really we know that we have an economy that really runs off the Ponzi population, housing and mining. And our taxation system leans people towards speculation. It encourages people to speculate on real estate. And that's really when economic crisis hit. We find that we have, it's not, you know, it doesn't matter what triggers a financial crisis. It's the fragility of the system when that financial crisis is triggered that really exposes the problem that we have here. And that means that we're then paying JobKeeper to ensure that the renters, for want of a, you know, the renters can keep paying the rentier class, you know, the landlords, the banking system, the monetary system, the rents of the land. So we really have a, particularly in the bigger cities in Australia, it's not so much evident, I don't think, you know, elsewhere, but particularly in Melbourne and Sydney, we have had very much boom and bust land cycles. So you can, for example, look at data that comes across and says that house prices will double every 7 to 10 years. And the way that they have calculated that is to look at the median prices of, say, some middle rings, you know, of some suburbs in Melbourne, for example. And it's just the middle price of a bunch of numbers. And indeed, if you look at the middle price of a bunch of sales statistics over, you know, 7 to 10 years, you'll have a doubling in various areas. But you can go and buy real estate and find that you've purchased something that is going nowhere in price. In fact, it's probably going backwards in price, for example, if you purchased an apartment, an inner city apartment, or if you follow one of the many property spruikers out there that try and take you out to some regional area because it's about to go off and promise you that you're going to get positive rental income and the golden egg of capital gains as well. And, you know, your property price goes nowhere. And then a financial crisis like this hits and you probably lose your renter. Or you can find areas where prices haven't just doubled in 10 years, they have tripled. And that is very much the reality in some of areas in Melbourne. So it is something where, I mean, look, the way that I really feel about it is I want people to have their eyes open to the reality of what's going on. So if they can understand why we have a property cycle, how the tax system plays into that and get wise about it, understand what property is worth. It's what the bank is going to lend, which is part of the economic cycle. It's worth what you can sell it for, right? So any property you buy, for example, you want it to appeal to as broad a buyer demographic as possible. So buying an apartment, where we know that 7 out of 10 investors buy apartments and they wax and wane, you know, then you know, and it's, and the people that live in apartments are mainly student renters. I used to say we'll run out of student renters before we run out of apartments, and we're actually now running out of student renters because of what, you know, the nature of this crisis. But yeah, I mean, you need to have really some understanding of it, because if you don't, you're going to open Facebook and you're going to open Instagram and you're going to see these, you know, property adverts that are going to go, no money, no down, you know, no money, and you'll make a fortune and, you know, you can buy for out in whoop and you'll be all right. So that's kind of really where the angle that I come from.
Mm. Well, that's a very interesting, and it's fascinating, even on the digital finance analytics YouTube channel, right? Some of the adverts that get run before the shows start are actually from those property spruikers, right? They're everywhere, right? And it's always the, you can't fail, you know, you can't lose, you can only probably ever goes up, you can borrow almost nothing and, you know, you can borrow almost everything and you don't need anything to put in yourself. And, you know, it's like this magic money machine, right? But the reality is that, you know, and reality is always much more painful than the you know, the visionary stuff that people talk about. The reality is that you can lose money as well as make money in property. And if you buy a dog of a property, it remains a dog of a property, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the government, in a way, of kind of the, it's not our long-term history, but our recent history is that because the economy is set up as it is, and because since people were breastfed, they've been breastfed on the notion that the way to get wealthy is to, you know, own your own home by the time you retire and to buy real estate. You know, they don't want you to retire on the government pension. They want you to speculate. And the taxation system obviously dictates how we invest. And because, you know, you get taxed very highly on your income and your productivity, but not so much on your real estate with you know, tax breaks. And even now, the news that came out here is that and this is something I'm very involved in because of the speculative vacancies report that we did at Prosper Australia. We, you know, eventually a vacancy tax was implemented, and our report was you know, part of the reason that that happened here. And now land tax and vacancy, the vacancy tax has been waived for property owners. And so that's, you know, the we have educated people here to believe in that the government is always going to bail out the property sector, and that's exactly what we're seeing now. And it's what we're seeing with the incentives. When you have a economy that is bent towards land speculation, then to get out of a financial crisis as quickly as possible, unless you're going to completely re-educate the population into, you know, taking away this idea that you need to speculate on land, then everything is thrown at the housing sector. Now, what's happening here is that there's a tremendous amount of money being thrown at infrastructure investment. And we know that if you throw money at infrastructure, that directly feeds into land prices. You know, build a new train station and the property prices go up. You know, the construction sector, I mean, what have we seen so far? You know, from the RBA, for example, at the beginning of all of this, they suggested shutting down the real estate industry to remove the perception that there was going to be any real estate crash. And then most recently, which is the report that, you know, would have you spitting out your tea, was the one that said that we have an apartment shortage. Well, I mean, only last year, the RBA were warning people, warning the financial sector about lending for apartments, because there were so many apartments that were being built in Melbourne and Brisbane in particular. And now suddenly we have an apartment shortage, and we have conversations going on. And again, I'm talking Melbourne-based here because of, you know, Melbourne's just been decimated. But conversations now about how we're going, you know, the Lord Mayor in Melbourne talking about how they are going to convert the office blocks into residential apartments. And we have no, you know, there's no students to fill them. It's just amazing. But of course, you can see what it's all leaning for. It's all leaning towards saving the property sector. And that's really, you know, ties into bringing international students back into the country, because they're the ones that are going to populate the inner city apartments. But yeah, and so I think because Australians have got used to the government bailing out that sector, they kind of feel that property is never going to die, because just like after the GFC, where, you know, up to 35 grand was given to first home buyers to go and buy a home, and property prices, where everywhere else in the world the property market was crashing between 2009 and 2010, our property prices over here went up by 25%. Just unbelievable. So people have a lot of faith that that's just going to be the way continue. But it wasn't historically always the case. You know, it's just very much recent history.
Well, if you look at the long-term trends, there have only been really two times when, in fact, prices went way higher than inflation, right? After the Second World War, and in the last 20, 30 years, with the deregulation and the cutting of interest rates and all of the other policy levers. Other than that, properties tend to drift higher at roughly the inflation rate. But just in terms of those vacancies, let's just be really clear. Your position is, and I think my data would confirm it as well, that there is plenty of vacant property in and around Melbourne.
An extraordinary amount of vacant property, and it waxes. It follows kind of the boom in the construction. So and also it becomes, and it's hidden. So the idea that we did, the reason behind the speculative vacancies report, we've been doing it for about 10 years now, so we have a fair bit of data behind it, was because the only metric for vacancies is the short-term vacancy rates, which is based on the amount of investor-owned property that is advertised compared to, you know, over a three-week period, you know, over a very short time period. We wanted to expose how many people were just holding onto properties that were vacant. And it can be for a number of reasons. It doesn't always have to be just because they're speculating. But I tell you what, they wouldn't be holding onto them if there was, you know, if they didn't think that at some point somebody was going to come along and pay more than what they purchased the property for. But when, you know, I mean, a few years ago, it was over 80,000 properties we identified as vacant for 12 months or more. there's a little bit of, you know, the data isn't 100% because we're doing it on, you know, either 0% water usage over a 12-month period. We have two metrics, and then very little water usage. So because of dripping taps or, you know, underutilization in a sense, you know, that if somebody, you know, if you're only using as much as flushing a toilet, just dropped something. If you're only using as much as flushing a toilet, for example, over a week or whatever it is, if it's a very low water usage, then we have two metrics where we include that also. And we've done it for the commercial sector as well. But there's a lot more vacancies out there than you realize. And then obviously in my own profession as a buyer advocate, you know, I mean, I've walked through apartment blocks where there's numerous vacant apartments. I've walked through apartment blocks in the city in Melbourne where I've been told that the owner only comes back for the Grand Prix, for example. So, I mean, it's very evident when you work within the industry, but it's just not known. We got the vacancy tax. It took a few years and really a lot of media attention before they started to take notice. We weren't advertising a vacancy tax. Policy, you know, our advocation is really for land to remove taxes elsewhere and to put them onto land, you know, to implement land taxation, to encourage building activity and to discourage vacancies. But they implemented a vacancy tax, low-hanging fruit, really.
Mm. Yeah, and the point there, of course, is that not all the vacancies are ever disclosed in any of the real estate statistics that are out there, as you say. Many people have bought property and just basically sitting on it, assuming that the value will go up over a number of years. And I've heard a few people argue that as soon as somebody goes into the property, you know, and it's no longer new, as it were, that actually devalues it. So it's better just to keep it in pristine condition and just let it sit there, right? And so I'm not sure that anybody really knows how many truly vacant properties there are around the place. You know, there might be some people could pop back occasionally, but it's certainly a much bigger number than traditionally would be approved of or indeed advocated by, for example, the construction sector, who continually argue we have not got enough property. And yet anybody with half a brain understands that actually there is plenty of property around. It's just that it might not be accessible. And that's a very different conversation point. It goes back to the broader issue, which you sort of touched on, which is the Ponzi scheme, which is build more, fund it more, lend more, build more. You know, increase the balance sheet, increase the size of the portfolio, and there's a superficial wealth creating mechanism there. But it is, frankly, superficial insofar that until you go to price discovery and actually know what your property is worth, you don't really know, do you?
Not at all. No, I mean, we could easily go down another tangent there, which is data. Hmm. And that ability of the public to access the data that they need to assess whether they're paying a reasonable price for a property. But the reason that people keep their, you know, the thing is the value is in the land. The value isn't in the building. And of course, you know, people will keep apartments empty because, you know, anybody should never really buy a new apartment because the value of the new building here will start depreciating before the locational value can appreciate and really go anywhere for an investor. So we, you know, you do see a lot of apartment blocks that are purchased and kept empty. That's been something that's been happening for a long time. And of course, the building quality, we've known it within the industry for years, that the building quality has been really poor, but now it's only being caught up. So you are right. This is all about people have to wise up to what is happening. And it is unbelievable how many people in the property industry still claim we have a shortage. Now, we don't have a shortage of roof space. We could house everybody quite comfortably in this country with the accommodation that we've got. What we've got is that we have unaffordable property where people can't access property at an affordable level within areas, you know, which are well serviced with infrastructure. Those things are dynamics that are within the market. But it's good to pay attention to the number of vacancies. We do it by suburb, so you can access our reports online and see how many vacant properties there are within your particular suburb. The only time you are going to see those vacancies is when we have a crisis like we have now. And if you look and see what's happening to the property market in Melbourne in particular, because let's face it, Melbourne is the state, you know, Victoria is the state that's been decimated, but Melbourne is the city that's really going to suffer. Mm. And that is the amount of apartment stock that is coming onto the market. It is an apartment apocalypse happening that agents within the inner city have never seen anything like it. When this first hit and all the short-term lets came online and the student renters kind of evacuated, it was an unprecedented amount of property. That's what you need to know. When the crisis are going to happen, and that's what I write about, obviously, in Cycles, Trends and Forecasts. It is predictable. The second thing that you need to understand is to protect yourself, if you are going to buy into real estate, knowing what to buy and where to buy, but also knowing what the dynamics are that you can't access in the data, because if you can't see it, you're not going to see it until the crisis hits. And that goes to something that I know that we both are invested in, which is accessing sales data, which is a problem.
Yeah, and just to be really clear, one of the amazing pieces of evidence that I keep seeing is that the prices being quoted on the public portals as to what a property is worth is based on the last available information, which is the asking price. But the settlement price is often quite disconnected from that. That doesn't come through necessarily for months. And then often, sort of squeezes through the back door. So there is this sort of hiatus between what the high level information is saying and what the real market is saying through price discovery. And of course, in a falling market or in a difficult market, those gaps can be very large. And yet the existing information flows that exist and are available for most people are actually telling the wrong story.
Well, for years, sales data has really only been available to any significant degree to real estate agents. You had to have a real estate agent's license to be able to access the databases. Now, when I access a database here of sales data, I can see the withheld prices. So there's a lot of conversation about real estate agents withholding prices. The reason that they do is because they either get a request typically from the buyer or the seller to withhold that information. And then because you're not going to be able to access it until settlement, as you said, which is 3 or 4 months down the line and too late to actually use it. And then the other problem that we have at the moment is that there's a lot of opaque is going on in the market because of the number of off-market sales. So transactions are extremely low. That, in a sense, is a real estate crash. It's just one that doesn't get recorded on price data, because the thing that really crashes the market at the end of the cycle is when you get a flood of foreclosures that hit the market. And, we haven't got that at the moment, and we're all aware that policy and lockdowns and things could force that situation. We'll just have to keep an eye on the market. But the other thing is that in markets like this, nobody wants to pay for advertising. So you don't see how many properties are on the market. So stock on market just suddenly becomes, it's relevant, but it's not as clear as it should be. And that's one of the things that you have to watch if you want to understand where prices are going to go. If you're suddenly starting to see a lot of uptick of stock, then there's going to be a bit of a downturn, particularly at times like this. I'll give you an example. In 2018, when we had the Royal Commission going on, it was a worse downturn than we're experiencing now. It was really bad. Nobody wanted to buy and nobody wanted to sell into that market. The market turned really before the election, and the first indication of it was, again, if you're working on the ground, you just suddenly saw that stock dried up. Because there'd been a lot of stock as prices had continued to fall throughout 2018, and people, owners, realized that prices weren't going to reverse and that it was just getting worse and worse. There was a rush of stock that went to the market, and as soon as we started to see those stock numbers drop, then the market, the clearance rate started to tighten up, and then the election just gave the kick you know, sort of at the end of that. So these are things that people, they need access to this data. And we have an absolute monopoly on real estate data. And it comes from CoreLogic, American-owned company that have a monopoly on real estate data, data that we used to be able to access at Prosper Australia to do our studies free of charge. Here we now have to pay thousands and thousands for, because they can charge whatever they want. You know, it's like when you see the land titles being sold off, being privatized. That should never be privatized. People, when it comes to housing, we should never have withheld prices. It should be very clear, and people should be allowed to make educated choices.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting, in New South Wales, you can still get transaction data from the titles registry, right? But that's not true now of a number of other states where effectively it's all been privatized and behind the veil.
Correct. I mean, it's really terrible, you know, what's going on. I mean, it's an interesting situation in Melbourne at the moment, because they've effectively stopped people selling their houses. So right now, you know, you might have bought into the market, but you can't sell in it because nobody can go and view a property or take photos of it, you know. So, I mean, it becomes a crazy situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, obviously, the local market there is, you know, pretty much frozen. And, of course, the auction clearance rates were very low. But a more general question about auction clearance rates, you know, they are overreported and overhyped like you wouldn't believe, for obvious reasons. But they really don't tell you very much at all, do they?
No, not at all. So only around, it depends on whether we're really in a boom. If we're in a boom market, then there'll be more properties auctioned than there will, say, if we're in a market like now. But around, you know, between sort of 15 to 20% of the entire property sales here are auctions. It's a very small percentage, and it happens predominantly in the middle and inner ring suburbs. You don't see it on the outskirts so much. And it really is just a monitor of the heat in the market. So they do give an indication, you know, of where prices are going to go, but that's because they, you know, they increase the volatility in the market, if you like, because it's a bit like standing on a trading floor. If you're a buyer and you've been to two or three auctions and you keep missing out, and you think, you know, you just get caught up in the whole thing of, well, I'm not going to miss out again. And like the auctioneers say, you know, give up your weekends, get back your weekends, you know, just 1,000 more. You know, so you go and pay a little bit more for the next one. But the auction market is a very small percentage. You know, the thing to look at is the number of transactions. And that's why I say we're effectively in a housing crash of what you see now, because when transactions really dry up, everything dries up. And, you know, that's where the state's getting their taxation dollars from, you know, is the stamp duties and everything. And so when you see people just, you know, the transactions freezing up, then that's probably more of an indication of the overall health of the real estate market than looking, you know, the actual percentage of dollars that have been transacted over any one weekend, other than looking at the auction clearance rates. Certainly it's not something to buy into.
Absolutely. Well, yes, please note it that some of those portals who week after week keep coming out with great news about auction clearance rates, and of course all the mainstream channels also reported on their evening news on a Saturday evening, right? It's like, why? I mean, it doesn't it's relatively meaningless.
It gives a little bit of an indication of the heat in the market. You know, so it's not, you don't want to base your research on it.
Absolutely. Now, you intrigued me by saying something at the start of the conversation about 18-year cycles, right? And I've done a couple of other shows with other people who are cycle believers, you know, from Harry Dent and other people too. I think it's worth just, as we sort of come to the end of this conversation, coming back to that, because the view you would have is that some of this is predictable.
It is. Look, cycles research is, some people buy into it and other people don't. But there's a lot of data sitting behind the 18-year real estate cycle, as too there is with a lot of cycles research, and that's why people start looking into it. It goes totally against the mainstream. In the US, there is an 18-year property cycle, which is very consistent, and there's a lot of data behind it. Now, I know you had Phil Anderson on the show not so long ago. Phil, I used to work with Phil. He's written a book on it about, you know, sort of what goes on in the US. But a lot of that data we've had locked up in the archives in Prosper, Australia, and also one of our associates, Fred Harrison, in the UK, has done a tremendous amount of research on the 18-year cycle going back to the 16th century in the UK, and he's really done more work than anyone else on it. That 18-year pattern is really consistent, and what you see is that there is a boom and a bust every 18 years in the real estate market. 18.6 years is the 18.6-year cycle, but within that 18 years, there is also what Fred Harrison termed as this kind of mid-cyclical downturn. It can be severe, as we're experiencing now, because this is actually timed for that within the 18-year cycle. Or it can be a bit like we had in 2001, which was the mid-cycle in the last 18-year cycle. So, you know, if you want to chart it back in Australia, you know, you have the 2008 GFC, which was effectively the end of the 18-year cycle. And we know that property didn't crash here because policy affects where real estate prices go. So the first thing to note is the 18-year cycle can be affected by policy. But you go back 18 years from 2008, you get back to 1991, right, which was the recession that we had to have, decimated the real estate market and never let anyone tell. You know, the trouble is we don't have the internet to really go back and see it documented as badly as it was, but it was really, really severe. You go back 18 years from that, you get back to the 1970s, which of course, you know, early 70s, which was a end of the real estate cycle and a real estate crash over here. And you can chart that back. The war has interrupted that cycle, so there are interruptions in it. Again, like I said, policy and what goes on in global events can come in the middle of that. But really what cycles do is they show you where the downturns, they give you a roadmap to where the downturns are going to come. And then how you navigate that roadmap really is, you know, knowing that roadmap is invaluable. Knowing the reason why property booms and busts within that cycle is the knowledge that you absolutely must have in order to, you know, we call it in Georgism seeing the cat. I say Georgism because the Prosper Australia is modeled on the advocacy of a chap called Henry George. He was an economist, lived in the 1890s, wrote a book called Progress and Poverty. And it was really when people really understand how the land is, you know, basically sits at the base of the economic system, how this speculative, you know, feudalist system works, and then you understand economics to a different level from how it's, you know, taught in the university system. So the 18-year cycle really did show that there was going to be a downturn this year. We, you know, it can be triggered by whatever it's going to be triggered. It doesn't have to be triggered by housing, but when the housing is crashed at the end, it normally is some form of mortgage crisis, you know, subprime crisis, a savings and loans crisis, so on and so forth. But, you know, we both know that you cannot have ever rising property prices, land prices, effectively, and that at some point that you're going to have a severe property crash. There's going to be a flood of foreclosures and people are not going to be able to pay the debts. So that's what the 18-year cycle is. There's a lot of evidence behind it. So I'd encourage anybody that wants to find out a little bit more about it is to have a look at the stuff that I write at Cycles, Trends and Forecasts, or reach out to me, and I'm more than happy to give some pointers as to where to start the research.
Great. Well, thanks. We'll put some of those links below because I think it's a very interesting. And Phil, the conversation I had with Phil was really interesting too. And, you know, the more you look at it, the more you realize that there's something really important in these trends. Okay, last question is this. For somebody who's thinking about property at the moment and perhaps buying a property for the first time, what's the one piece of advice that you would give them above all else?
There's three P's in property, right? So you've got to know where your budget is, right? Price, property, and your position. New property and your position are two compromises, and your price is fixed. So you need to know where your budget is. But always remember that the value is in the land. It doesn't matter whether that land is 300 square meters or 700 square meters in size. The zoning will dictate what you can do with that block of land. Buying, for example, if you take a bird's eye view of some of the middle ring suburbs in Melbourne, what you see is a process of gentrification, if you like. You'll see it in Brisbane, same in Sydney. That is that the 600 square meter blocks of land are disappearing because they're slowly being subdivided into 2, 3, 4, and 5, right? Mm. So buying a block of land, say, in an area like that, where those blocks of land are being subdivided, you're immediately then owning something that is reducing in supply in an area that's being subdivided up. It's a process of gentrification, because as the population moves in, the developers know they can make a buck. They subdivide the land, sell off the townhouses. So buying an old suburban house and a block of land, the value is in the land. So, you know, my advice to anyone starting out, really, if they want to take advantage, if they've got the knowledge of the cycle and they understand it and they want to take advantage of it in property, you can make a lot of money out of wise property investment in this country in terms of capital growth, right? But it's understanding that, you know, the first thing you've got to do is get something in your portfolio that is going to accrue capital growth. And it's really identifying those blocks of land and those locations that are going to do that. So I generally usually start with somebody on teaching them how to, you know, work out what you can put on a block of land, work out how the zoning works, work out how to identify those locations that are going to go up, and then finding something that you can stick a renter in, and, you know, then having something that you perhaps develop in the future. That's normally where I start.
Mm. And that's the point, isn't it? It's about doing the work, doing the analysis, and starting the analysis from the right point of view, because then the outcome can be quite different from if you start from the wrong starting point. Look, I really have enjoyed this conversation. Thank you very much for spending some time with me today. And I might see whether I can come back and have another go down the track, because there are so many other things I'd like to explore. But thanks once again for your time. And is there a particular website that you would point people to if they want to follow you and get more information?
Yeah, there's a few. Well, they can go to cashmorecode.com.au. They can have a look at what we do at Prosper, prosper.org.au, or go to Fat Tail Media Cycles. Just Google Fat Tail Media Cycles Trends and Forecasts and have a look there. You know, they'll find ways to reach out.
Just terrific. Well, send me the links and I'll make sure they're also in the comments below. Thanks very much for your time today.
I will do.
And keep
Thanks
safe down there in Victoria.
Yeah, will do. Thanks so much, Martin. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks. Take care.
Thanks.